Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's Giannata's sunglasses. Oh, I wish there's Giannata's sunglasses. If he's not his sunglasses, then I'd show you messages hiding before your very eyes.
Well, good morning. You are tuned to KBOO in Portland, where the time is 9:02 and a half, and time for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Clayton Morgridge. I'll be hosting the show. Our engineer is Patricia Kullberg. The mole is the beast that works underground, invisible to the masters of capital, whose mountains of oppressive structures and ideologies the mole works to expose and undermine. Among those structures and ideologies is patriarchy, the consignment of women, along with people of color, to subordinate status where they can be paid little or nothing for their domestic labor as wives raising the next generation of workers in the home or in child care centers. They are also paid less for all kinds of caring work, work such as waitressing, cleaning, and even teaching. It's safe to say that women's work holds up more than half the structure of capitalism while being subordinated in many obvious and subtle ways to the privilege of men, especially rich men. Of course, women have always organized and fought back. This Friday, March 8th, is International Women's Day, and on today's Old Mole, we are going to be looking at some of what women are doing to gain equal voice and power, and to combine with their male allies to reduce and eliminate the power of capital over all our lives. In a moment, we'll be hearing from the Old Mole's Fran Michel about the history of Women's Day and about the actions being planned by the International Women's Strike USA for this Friday, March 8th, here in Portland and elsewhere. An inspiration for the Women's Strike is the pamphlet Feminism for the 99%, a manifesto. And one of its authors, Cynthia Aruzza, will be with us to talk with Bill Resnick and make the claim that feminism must be anti-capitalist, eco-socialist, and anti-racist. I'll be talking with filmmaker, psychologist, and Old Mole Jan Hocken about her newest film, Our Bodies, Our Doctors, which tells the rarely discussed story of what it means to be an abortion provider today. And then to wrap up the show, Joe Clement talks with union organizer Kevin Dugan about Mark Fisher's book, Capitalist Realism. They consider the challenges it poses to organizing unions and why there is an alternative to capitalism if we fight for it. So stay tuned for all that. If you want to hear any of it again or recommend it to your friends, you'll be able to find the whole show as well as its separate parts on the KBOO website. That's kboo.fm/oldmole. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter. And now, here is Fran Michel with an overview of the women's strike and the manifesto Feminism for the 99%.
Friday, March 8th is International Women's Day. As faithful Mole listeners may recall, the holiday has its origins in class struggle and socialist politics of the early 20th century. In New York, in 1908, 15,000 women garment workers, the majority of them immigrants, marched through the heart of Manhattan to demand better pay, shorter work hours, and suffrage. A year later, women immigrant textile workers were on strike against the sweatshops where they were forced to work, facing down police violence and repression by the owners. In 1910, inspired by the struggle of the women workers, German socialist Clara Zetkin called on attendees at the International Conference of Working Women to organize an International Working Women's Day. Women delegates from over 17 countries voted unanimously to pass the motion. In 1917, thousands of Russian women, workers and wives of soldiers, took to the streets on March 8th to demand peace and bread, and started the uprising that would overturn the Tsarist regime. International Women's Day has been recognized by the United Nations since 1975. But in 2017, feminist organizers called for a return to the radical roots of the day and for international solidarity against neoliberalism. They called for a women's strike with an anti-capitalist vision that rejects the lean-in liberal feminism of the bosses and demands a feminism for the 99%. Their platform calls for an end to gender violence, reproductive justice for all, labor rights, a welfare system providing universal health care, education and access to benefits, anti-racist and anti-imperialist feminism, and environmental justice for all. This Friday, in Portland, we're all invited to strike near the end of the conventional working day. At 4 p.m. in Pioneer Courthouse Square, speakers will talk about women's leadership in labor and political struggles around the world. At 5 p.m., participants will march to Salmon Street Springs, the fountain at the intersection of NATO Parkway and Southwest Salmon in Waterfront Park. To clarify, the women's strike is not the women's march. The U.S. Women's March has usually been held in January, since 2017, which saw a massive protest against Trump and a lot of pink hats. This year, in several cities around the U.S., the January March was canceled because of concerns about racism and charges of anti-Semitism, as well as hostility toward some of the organizers' pro-Palestinian political positions. In Portland, the Women's March was rescheduled to March 3rd, after objections that the original January date conflicted with Don't Shoot Portland's traditional Reclaim MLK Day march. The Portland Women's March disaffiliated from the national group, but remained an officially permitted event with corporate sponsorship. Its stated mission is to harness the political and organizational power of diverse women and our communities to create transformative social change. But the International Women's Strike U.S. has a more specific political vision, protesting not just against Trump and his misogynist policies, but also against the conditions that produced Trump, namely the decades-long economic inequality, criminalization and policing, racial and sexual violence, and imperial wars abroad. Their platform is elaborated in the Women's Strike Manifesto, written by three of the U.S. organizers, Chinsia Aruza, Tithi Bhattacharya, and Nancy Fraser, and published by Verso Books. It's titled Feminism for the 99% and is available from the Multnomah County Library. It makes the case that feminism shouldn't start or stop with seeing women represented at the top of society. It must start with those at the bottom and fight for the world they deserve. And that means targeting capitalism. Aruza, Bhattacharya, and Fraser argue that neoliberal capitalism has caused global economic, social, political, and environmental crisis, and that to create a more stable, equitable, and humane world, we need a feminism that centers the women most marginalized, silenced, and harmed by neoliberalism. Working women, women of color, Native women, disabled women, immigrant women, Muslim women, lesbian, queer, and trans women. Central to their argument is the importance of social reproduction. The work of making and maintaining human beings and human social life is overwhelmingly performed by women and devalued under capitalism. In the excerpt from the manifesto published late last year in New Left Review, they argue that we are living through a crisis of society as a whole, and its root cause is capitalism. Gender oppression in capitalist societies is rooted in the subordination of social reproduction to production for profit. We want to turn things right side up. Gender violence takes many forms, all of them entangled with capitalist social relations. Capitalism was born amid racist and colonial violence, and capital has been destroying the earth. Capitalism is incompatible with real democracy and peace. Instead, they call for an anti-racist, anti-imperialist, eco-socialist, feminist internationalism that works to bridge feminist, labor, and other movements, calling for building a common anti-capitalist insurgency. Describing their motives in calling for the 2017 women's strike, organizers explained that they wanted, first, to bring back the idea of the impossible. In the early 20th century, women in general and textile workers in particular were considered impossible to organize. Yet the women striking in 1908 and 1909 in New York apprehended the impossible. And we need the impossible today. We need to think beyond what Mark Fisher called capitalist realism, the idea that, as Margaret Thatcher said of capitalism, there is no alternative. It's time to demand the impossible, to make the alternative, the other world that's necessary. Second, strike organizers wanted the demand for bread to be reunited with the demand for roses. The labor organizer Rose Schneiderman used the phrase bread and roses in 1912 while organizing against sweatshops in the wake of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire. What the woman who labors wants, she said, is the right to live, not simply exist. The right to life and the sun and music and art. The worker must have bread, but she must have roses, too. Decades of neoliberalism have not just taken the bread away from the tables of working women and families, but also taken away the infrastructures that sustain life, the roses. Hospitals and schools have closed, while prisons and police have multiplied. The fight for wages cannot be separated from the means that sustain life. The history of women self-organizing and fighting for economic and political rights has been erased from memory in the United States and needs to be reclaimed. And this tradition of women's radical labor struggles is being revived. As the strike organizers note in this year's call, 2018 was a year of formidable strike actions, organized from below and led by women. From the teachers in West Virginia and Arizona to the hotel workers in the Marriott and Hilton chains, successful strikes of women have shaken our labor movement and delivered the goods. At the same time, we recognize that rallies, picket lines, teach-ins, and forums will be the first steps to reclaiming March 8th as a day for working women in many areas of the country. Join us Friday at 4 in Portland's Pioneer Courthouse Square to help build the movement that will win us not just bread, but also roses. For the Old Mole Variety Hour, this has been Fran Michel.
And that's a bit of Bread and Roses. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour here on KBOO, where we just heard Fran Michel filling us in on the women's strike. I'm Clayton Morgridge. Now here is Bill Resnick to talk with Cynthia Aruzza about the women's strike and the pamphlet Feminism for the 99%, a manifesto which she wrote along with Titi Bacharia and Nancy Fraser. Here's Bill.
Cynthia Aruzza, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you so much.
Cynthia Aruzza teaches at the New School for Social Research in New York City. She's also an activist. She writes. She co-authored with Titi Bhattacharya and Nancy Fraser the book Feminism for the 99%, a manifesto. It's new from Verso Press, goes on sale this week. Today we'll be talking about feminism for the 99% and the movements all across the world on so many issues, from wages to love to violence to dignity, towards a real democracy where everybody has real voices, to health for people and the environment, and pressing for more. These various and many eruptions and all the organizing, they could bring to life a powerful international movement that would change the nature of things. And that's desperately needed, of course. First, though, Cynthia, you observed the women's marches in New York City on January 19th this year, and you've also contributed to organizing the International Women's Strike. It's happening next Friday, March 8th. Millions of women, some men, not going to work, singing and marching in most of the big cities of Europe and Latin America, smaller cities too, and elsewhere. Though in the U.S., a few major marches in New York City and Los Angeles, and here a march at 4 p.m. in Pioneer Courthouse Square. So, Cynthia, tell us about the women's strike.
Yeah, so the women's strike started in 2016. With the strikes organized by Polish women against the abortion ban and by women in Argentina against femicide and against gender violence. And then from these two countries, it actually expanded to the rest of the world with the organization of the first international feminist strike or women's strike on March 8, 2017. So since then, the movement has kept growing. So, for example, last year in Spain, 5 million people, men and women, went on strike and participated in mass demonstrations around the country. And also in Italy, the most radical unions called for general strikes. So hundreds of thousands of people went on strike, and the same in Argentina. And this year again, the movement is expanding to yet new countries. For example, Chile, Brazil, Germany, Switzerland, Belgium, Turkey, and so on. So I think we are in the middle of a new feminist wave. And what is interesting is the fact that this new feminist wave is using strikes as a form of struggle, also as a form of political identity. And by doing this, it is showing the labor that women perform, both unwaged and waged labor, showing also women's power that depends on this labor, that is also the reproductive labor that reproduces human beings and societies. But the feminist movement is also playing a more general role, which is that of re-democratizing the strike. So in other words, that of saying it is not true that only unions can call for strikes in around the world. Generally speaking, unions are not very prone to call for strikes. So the feminist movement is actually pressuring the organized labor movement, trying to radicalize it, trying to democratize it. And in cases like Spain or Italy, also managing to persuade big unions to call for strikes. So it is actually mobilizing and also playing a very important political role, not just in terms of feminist movement, but in general for the left and for the rebuilding of a class movement.
Right. You know, it's somehow it seems to me like it's a wildcat strike, not authorized by any sort of contract or not authorized by the head of a union. It's a contract strike that sort of comes from below, that rises up when people get fed up and when they're looking for the sort of solidarity in struggle. And also, it's not just in reproduction, it's also in production. It's in both.
Yeah.
Women are exploited. They're at the lowest. They're in very precarious and low-paid positions and vulnerable positions throughout the economy, along with, of course, many, many, many men.
Yeah, exactly. And by the way, it is also what is happening is also significant because many women work in sectors where there are no unions or jobs are very precarious, so there are no labor rights. There is not the possibility of striking in a legal way. So the movement is actually providing the tools where it is really strong, the tools for these women to actually organize also in the workplace and go on strike by organizing wildcat strike or, you know, calling sick, this kind of thing. So it combines legal strikes with wildcat strikes, especially for women who do not have labor rights because of the kind of labor they perform.
It's also withholding their labor in the economy. It seems to me that, as you have written, it combines the sort of class issues, the economic class issues, with the women's issues in very productive ways. Instead of allowing a tension between identity issues and economic issues.
Yeah, exactly. I think that the movement is going well beyond what we may call liberal feminism. So if feminist politics is not based on identity or just the critique of language or culture, this, of course, is present too. But this is a movement rooted in class struggle. So it is basically overcoming the divide between identity politics and class politics. And also, in addition to the issue of gender, this movement is also mobilizing against migration policies carried on by governments around the world that are having a very serious impact on the life of migrant women and refugees. So it combines also the issue of race, not just gender and class.
This is Bill Resnick for The Old Mole on KABU Radio 90.7 Portland, talking to Cinzia Arruza, who co-wrote Feminism for the 99%. She wrote it with Tithi Bhaichara and Nancy Fraser. She also co-wrote Feminism for the 99%. We're talking about today the women's strike, which is a central component in organizing. It's an eruption from below that the Feminism for the 99%, it's the mechanism, the powerful mechanism for, in fact, winning feminism for the 99%. Tell us, though, about this country. Why is in the U.S., in Europe and Latin America in particular, there are really quite powerful movements. What's happening here?
Well, I think that there was the possibility for a feminist movement, for a mass feminist movement in the United States, because it is sufficient to think about the first two women's marches, so immediately after the inauguration and then the day after. These were really massive, massive demonstrations, and they were feminist demonstrations. And we may also think about the Me Too movement that actually played a very important role in the United States, even if it was especially on social media and so on, but actually did also have some impact on workplaces and so on. The problem is that I think there were, besides the usual difficulties about organizing the United States and the objective difficulty, we are rebuilding the left here, but clearly there is less of a stable tradition of mobilization, class struggle, and so on. But I think there are two elements that have played a negative role. One element is has to do with the fact that the Women's March adopted as an organizational model that of an NGO. And I think Kianga Yamata-Taylor explains this very well in an article in The Nation about the Women's March. And this form of organization didn't really facilitate a process of mobilization from below. At the same time, they were the point of reference for millions of people who were interested in feminism. So clearly, the choices they made in terms of forms of organization did play a role. And then the second problem, I think, has to do with the elections. So last year, the Women's March had as one of its main slogans, power to the polls. And the idea was precisely that the resistance needed to move from the streets to the ballot. So basically the idea was that one way to move forward was to elect as many women representatives as possible. Now, I think this contributed to demobilize somehow. It's the opposite of what happened in a number of countries where there was a process of, activation from below. And this year, on top of this, unfortunately, the Women's March was made the target of, for me, completely unbased, ungrounded accusations of antisemitism coming from, especially from the right wing of the Democratic Party. And this, of course, put the Women's March in a situation of political difficulty, because this kind of media campaign was started against them. Again, I do think the accusations are basically opportunistic, ungrounded. So this year, the women's marches were much smaller and many were cancelled because of this. Now, in this context, as International Women's Strike, we tried to organize a more class struggle feminism, and we did succeed in organizing a women's strike in 2017 that shut down three school districts and so on. Mm-hmm. But we didn't have, honestly, the resources and the visibility that were necessary to then solidify this kind of work. And in the absence of a mobilization of the women's march, we didn't manage to trigger a process of mobilization. However, I want to say something that something interesting that is happening in the United States is the fact that the women are, in any case, mobilizing, even if not as feminists. Because if we look at the strike wave, so the teacher strike, and then the strikes of nurses, and the possibility of further strikes in the sector of hospitality, this is a mostly female workforce. So, in a sense, we didn't manage to have a feminist movement in the United States, but what is happening is that in any case, women are mobilizing and are leading the struggle in the workplaces, but also for the defense of quality education, quality healthcare, and so on. So this says something about this period globally, in the sense that women are really taking a leading role in a number of struggles, from the feminist movement to ecological struggles to strikes.
This is KBOO Radio 90.7, Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Cinzia Arruza. We've been discussing the feminism for the 99%. It's going on sale this week. We've been talking about the women's strike, which is this sort of powerful uprisings, wildcat uprising compared to a wildcat strike where people self-organize rather than going out on strike, which is also good, but happens much less often. They seem as spontaneous eruptions from below, but they're prepared in all sorts of ways. It seems to me, Cynthia Arruza, we're living in a period where the left is not powerful enough, although some people have thought that, and then revolutions developed very quickly. But it could be a while until, let's say, some kind of combined economic environmental crisis can't be solved through capitalist means. They just can't keep growing in the same way. The international accounts and economic system could, in fact, begin freezing and collapsing in ways that they're unable to deal with. And also, growth for profits is what's leading to this enormous global heating. They're going to be trapped at some point. Now, it could come earlier than later. Right now, though, we are building. It seems to me the women's strike and the various manifestations from below that are surprising, the school teachers and the other actions in the United States, also in Spain and around the world, they take different forms. But there's a sort of realization amongst the entire group of working people that things are going wrong. And right now it's sort of self-protection. Sometimes it's things like the women's strike. People take, there are many forms. But at some point, it seems to me, we're going to see where people are going to understand they have to do it together. The people on top are corrupt and unable to deal with what's happening. You know, it'll take time, and I don't think, but we have some time, and we have to sort of be patient. You know, if one demonstration is not as big as we'd want it to be, there's no reason to feel terrible, because there's this momentum that seems to me to be building.
Yeah, no, I agree. I moved from Italy to the United States in 2010, and when I arrived here, I really thought I wanted to go back to Europe because I have always been an activist, and I didn't see where I could be active. The situation seemed desperate to me. And then Occupy happened and changed the conversation around the country. Then Black Lives Matter, then the Sanders campaign, the 5-for-15 campaign. I mean, if we look at the last 8 years, what is happening in the United States is quite remarkable in the sense that there is really a process of radicalization. There is, especially of young people, but not only. We have, you know, until a couple of years ago, people were saying, you know, scholars were claiming that the strike was dead because nobody was going on strike anymore in the United States. And this year we have a strike wave. So I think actually, this is a very, very interesting moment, especially in the United States, but not only. Clearly, we operate in a situation that is extremely complicated because we are in the middle of a crisis that is not just economic. It is also a crisis of social reproduction. It's an ecological crisis, and it is a political crisis. And it is sufficient to look at the rise of, you know, of the far right from Brazil to Italy, Poland, all this Eastern Europe, and the United States. So clearly we are operating in a situation that is very complicated and that is also dangerous. But I think what is changing is that, you know, an increasing number of people is coming to understanding that without a mobilization from below, there is no possibility of changing the situation. We cannot rely on progressive neoliberals. We cannot just rely on elected representatives. We do need to mobilize. We do need to struggle. We do need to go on strike. We do need to block the streets and so on and build movements and also build alliances among the various movements and the various struggles. And I think this is actually happening. Of course, it's going to be probably a long process because, yes, I agree that the left is not in a very good shape anywhere in the world. But this new wave of strikes and struggle, and especially on an international level, this new feminist wave, I think, can really help us rebuild what we have to rebuild in order to start transforming our social relations.
Cinzia Rusa, that's a great place to end the interview, I think. One thing we didn't talk about, Cinzia, is the way in which our movements can be either reformist in a sense that they just sort of help the powers that be keep control, or they can be sort of non-reformist, that is, build consciousness of that other world, build a sense of power, build the capacity to collectively express power, and also build a sense that of deservingness, that in fact that's broad working people can solve the problem collaboratively, and in fact the elites cannot.
Yeah, I mean, there is no contradiction between the idea, you know, a revolutionary project of transformation of the society, and also, you know, getting rid of capitalism and reforms. So there is no contradiction about, you know, fighting for universal health care or for minimum wage or for, you know, clean energy, and at the same time also building toward a rupture with capitalism. Clearly, the issue is how we do fight for reforms. So whether, I think one of the dangers is to expect just that reforms are going to be passed on by elected representatives in institutions, and to rely too much on representation, on state institutions, and so on. While I do think that even from the viewpoint of getting reforms, I do think that actually the moments in which really important reforms have been passed in a number of countries historically is the moment in which there was activation from below, there was empowerment from below, there were really massive movements. So I do think that we can and we should fight for a number of reforms and organize around them today, but at the same time do it in such a way as to increase empowerment from below and democracy from below. So without, you know, thinking that a party or elected representative will do it for us.
Cinzia, thanks so much for talking to us. And
thank you for having me.
For more of Cinzia Rusa and Tithi Bhattacharya and Nancy Fraser, the co-authors of Feminism for the 99%, on sale this week.
Tuesday.
Yeah. It's 96 pages. It's really worthwhile. And have a good women's strike Friday. So long.
Bye-bye.
We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and family. More than a paycheck to our loved ones and family.
I wanted more. But what I've got here today is more than I bargained for. When I walk through that door, I bring home asbestosis and silicosis, long black lung disease, and radiation hits.
And that's more than a paycheck. By Sweet Honey of the Rock. Following Bill Resnick's conversation with Cinzia Rusa about Feminism for the 90%. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on here on KBOO, the radio station you sponsor for the community, a community that extends far beyond its home base here in Portland to everyone who wants to understand our world. I'm Clayton Morgridge, and I'm joined now by filmmaker and fellow Old Mole, Jan Hocken, to talk about her latest film, Our Bodies, Our Doctors. Welcome, Jan.
It's good to be here.
So what led you to the topic for this film? Would you say that the issues facing abortion providers have changed in the last few years?
Well, I've been involved in the reproductive rights movement and women's health care for many decades. Before I became a filmmaker, I was an activist and academic working on reproductive rights, and have seen over time some shift and also some continuity in the pro-choice movement, abortion rights as an issue both, and the anti-abortion forces. I was part of the Portland Reproductive Rights Coalition here in Oregon, organizing the 80s as the anti-abortion movement was really mounting an increasingly violent campaign of threats, and around nine providers, mostly doctors, were killed in the 1990s. Clinics were bombed. Threats were pervasive. It was a period of tremendously horrifying terrorism against providers and clinics. It was part of the clinic defense initiatives so that women and staff could get to clinics as they walked a gauntlet of threats during that period. Now, that has changed. The harassment is more subtle. There were lawsuits filed and a lot of opposition that did defeat some of the most violent currents in the anti-abortion movement. But abortion remains, still carries a powerful weight as a signifier in the right. And when I started this film, I was struck by how, even though most people agree that abortion, access to abortion should be legal, how much the anti-abortion forces have dominated visual culture. I mean, if you look up abortion, most of what you see are, you know, bloody fetuses and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I found that.
And that we really, as the reproductive rights movement, or what's now called reproductive justice movement, which is a broader campaign that includes abortion, we need to reclaim visual culture. And this film, Our Bodies, Our Doctors, was a way of reclaiming also the complexity of this issue, which has been, I think, kind of narrowly taken up by the pro-choice movement. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're talking about how big of an issue it is as a signifier for the right. Do you have any sense as to why that is? I mean, what sort of politically feeds the anti-abortion movement so strongly?
Well, part of what drew me into this was anti-stigma research, working with the University of Michigan on two earlier projects on dynamics that perpetuate stigma and the silencing and the shame and the stigma attached to abortion. One part of this dynamic was people are afraid of talking about abortion, even people who have abortion or perform them. So this project was to bring abortion into everyday conversation. It's still a taboo in movies and film and television. You know, a long time ago, you didn't see people having sex in movies. You did not see birth or even pregnant women far back. Abortion remains a taboo other than a crisis in a couple where you might see the fetal heart monitor. But you don't see abortion typically taken up as a normal part of women's lives. So that was important. Many of the providers in this film also deliver babies and care, provide other forms of care, so as well as terminating pregnancies. So it's important to just see it as part of women have throughout history tried to control their fertility. It's part of life, part of women's lives. And it's important, just as bringing children into the world is important to acknowledge and support, so to deciding not to.
In terms of the taboo on talking about it, and which of course then leads to fear to even investigating what you could do about a problem pregnancy, does your work as a psychoanalytic psychologist sort of help to explain that, and does that enter into the film in any way?
Well, part of one idea that I think people are familiar with is how people who carry out certain jobs that are socially necessary can be a lot of diffuse anxiety and fear can be projected onto them. So you have fear projected onto migrants, and then these people are demonized. And those in authority say, these are the threats to an otherwise peaceful world that I preside over and protect you from the threat. Well, doctors who perform abortion are providers, and they're mostly doctors, but there are many other people involved in this care. They also have been demonized by the right wing. You know, Trump recently saying, these people want to rip a baby out of the woman's body, which is, of course, absurd. But it's this demonizing, and it turns something into its opposite, which is like a kind of reaction formation. The things you need and depend on, people who actually are providing a loving, in a way, form of care, being there for women during a time of need, are seen as the opposite. So from a psychoanalytic perspective, it's also been interesting to me what this issue represents, the fetishizing of the fetus, this fixation on even early gestational products. While the woman, the body around that is vacated, the environment children come into in the world is corrupted in ways that are defended by these people. So it becomes kind of this A fetish object is something you can fixate on to ignore everything around it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I worked with that idea and tried to bring the surround, including the people who are there for women, the work world, to demystify it in this film, because it's still quite hidden and often mystified.
Mm-hmm. Could you say a little bit more specifically about the film and like what we see in the film?
Well, part of what was very moving, there are many films about now, or a number of good films about the barriers for women seeking abortion, but this is really about the people who are committed to doing this work and go to work every day and face often a lot of harassment in the field of medicine. So it's really about the struggle in the healthcare field, including about religious control over healthcare decisions. And it's not just a story about the horrifying threat, the diminishing frontier we face around abortion rights. It's also about brave people who are pushing back. And some mm-hmm. of the gains they've made as a new generation of feminist doctors has fought for this being part of expected training in the healthcare field. I wanted to make a film that's also inspiring, and I think it is an inspiring story, as well as a story about people facing hard choices. And you see some of the emotional complexity of terminating pregnancies mm-hmm. and issues that come up for providers throughout the course of the film.
You talked about sort of reclaiming the visual, the image for this perspective. How do you see that sort of feeding into the political process of defending the right to abortion?
Well, increasingly, particularly the attack on women and providers in the second trimester, which is further along, it's more medically difficult, and for some people more emotionally difficult, because there's a recognized fetus that comes out, and almost without exception, these are women who are poor or in very stressful conditions and are pushed into that later period because of all the barriers around the country. And so I think it's really important to recognize this as an issue of reproductive justice that affects poor women, minority women disproportionately, and that the people who do this work need our support as well. So I hope people want to rise up and support people who do this work and learn more about how to talk about the issue
mm-hmm.
and to go beyond just like pro-choice banners and slogans. Mm-hmm. But I've been amazed how little people know, actually, even pro-choice people, about the nature of abortion care and what it means for people mm-hmm. that inhabit this work world and involve in this form of reproductive care and justice.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, Jen, maybe we should talk about when this film is being shown.
Yeah, it's a wonderful way to spend International Women's Day this Friday. It's part of the Portland International Film Festival. That's the world premiere of the film. Once again, it's called Our Bodies, Our Doctors. It's this Friday at 8:45 at the Witzel Auditorium, and again Tuesday, March 8th, this Friday. March 12th, Tuesday, also at the Witzel Auditorium.
Yeah, and that one's at 6.
Yeah. Okay. So I hope as many people come out to support also Great. The people who've been so brave to be part of this.
Definitely, yeah. Thanks a lot for being here, Jen.
Thanks for having me.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO here in Portland. I'm Clayton Morgridge. Fran Michelle at the top of the hour mentioned Mark Fisher's book, Capitalist Realism. You know, the kind of realism that says nothing that doesn't fit within capitalist ideas and capitalist practices is realistic. Capitalism defines the limits of what is possible. Well, here are two moles, Joe Clement and Kevin Dugan, with experience in organizing workers and tenants' unions, to testify to the contrary and to discuss Fisher's book.
I'm Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm joined today by fellow union organizer and just friend of mine, Kevin Dugan. Thanks for coming on the Old Mole, Kevin.
Hey, Joe. Thanks for having me.
So we wanted to talk about a book that came out a couple years ago by a now-deceased writer named Mark Fisher. The book's called Capitalist Realism, Is There No Alternative? It is a very thin volume. It kind of just grew out of things that he wrote on his blog, but it's a very interesting set of diagnoses about the way that capitalist ideology works today. And Kevin and I want to talk about that in the context of efforts to organize workers into unions or into other kinds of working class organizations. To start out with, Kevin, could you say just a little bit about your experience with union organizing?
Yeah, I've been a union organizer for about 10 years. I've worked for a few different unions, all like in education, K-12 education and higher education unions. In particular, I've helped people organize new unions, what they call external organizing. It's been the main thing that I've done, and mostly in Portland and Oregon.
So Mark Fisher's argument in Capitalist Realism is that Margaret Thatcher's quote about there is no alternative to capitalism has become this generalized hegemonic reality, and that we are under more and more pressure to think of our experiences and just reality itself through the lens of atomic individualism, and that this leads us to be depressed as well as like addicted to things that bring us pleasure, that bring us a certain kind of jolt, and that this is a pervasive problem and has a lot to do with how we look at how the powers that be continue to dominate the world. How is this useful, Kevin, for thinking about the task of organizing workers to put an end to all this? Or how does this come up in your work experience or your union experience?
I mean, the first thing is that when you start organizing in most contexts, the first problem that you run into is not that people don't want better conditions. They don't want you know, better pay. They don't want more job security, or they don't want, you know, more, you know, like a sense of like mental health. They don't want to feel less stressed like that. There's no one that's arguing against those things. It's people don't want to believe that it's even possible, because that's kind of frightening and terrifying. They don't want to get their hopes up. You know, you don't want to believe that there's something that's possible. That's the sort of the first challenge, is getting past that belief, the belief that we can do something better.
And, you know, when we're talking about unions, like there is this issue of who do unions represent, who are they working for, and that Mark Fisher, in talking about these concepts that he borrows from the psychoanalytic theory of Jacques Lacan of like the big other, is trying to get us to consider the way in which regulations, law, power, and authority in a capitalist society and economy all function by this complex Baroque Kafkaesque series of deflections and responsibility being shifted. Could you say a bit about how that shows up in work life and your union organizing experience?
Yeah, I mean, I think the example from the book offers a good starting point, where in a lot of jobs you end up with sort of this endless maze of bureaucracy. The one thing in a campaign that I recently worked on, organizing graduate employee researchers, the primary issue that motivated a lot of people was the administration had restructured a program. And as they rolled out that restructuring for the people that were in the first year, they did a bunch of listening sessions. They did surveys. They engaged people in this sort of, you know, feedback of like, what do you think of this? And the grad researchers put in a lot of effort to that because they really cared. They're really invested. They're new in this program. And then they found that the administration just didn't listen to them. They just completely disregarded it. And that happened over and over. And they raised that question. And that was the sort of thing. They're like, well, what's the point of doing this if it doesn't really go anywhere? And I think that, like, that was the thing that motivated them to then try to organize a union, because they wanted to have a voice. It wasn't necessarily a material condition. It wasn't, you know, a lack of pay or, you know, no health insurance. It was the lack of voice in what they're doing.
One of Fisher's recurring points has to do with the privatization of different aspects of our life, privatization especially of problems. Could you say how that comes up in your organizing experience?
The issues that people want to organize around in a lot of cases are like stress. And it's these things that, because of the structure, they're viewed as individual problems. People don't talk about them.
And you're encouraged not to talk about them.
Yeah, you're encouraged not to talk about them on a bunch of different levels. So that's the process of organizing. One of the things is that you have to talk to your coworkers. You have to talk to your coworkers about things that, you know, maybe you don't want to. You have to, you know, somehow be vulnerable, if not to other people, to yourself. And it turns out that when you do talk about those things, you start to realize that the causes are actually structural. It reminds me of I think it's an essay, the Personal is Political, where that originally came out, was about women who were organizing and talking about their, you know, issues in their personal lives, and people at first arguing, saying, oh, those are not political issues, and she wrote this thing and said, actually, it turns out that they are, you know, they're structural, that domestic violence, you know, or other, like, seemingly, like, personal issues are actually, like, the result of capitalism and the patriarchy and all these big structures.
So I know you've had recent experience with a big institution telling workers not to think of themselves as a collective subject. Could you tell us about the recent win with OHSU grad students getting a union?
Yeah. So over a year ago, these grad workers, as I referenced earlier, started talking about having a union. So we went through the process of, you know, organizing, talking to people, lots of conversations, pushing workers to have conversations with each other, got to a majority, went public with the union, and the first thing the administration, the next thing they do is say, you can't have a union, you are students, not employees, and unions are for employees. And so as an institution, they are literally telling people that the only legitimate, like, subject you can have is as individuals, because students are regarded as individuals, not as this, like, collective subject.
The union,
yeah. And the union is like twofold. There's the union as the institution, you know, the institution that I worked for, and that is made up of members and stewards and such. And then there's this case, the union of grad student researchers who are building a collective consciousness by having these conversations, by sort of collectivizing their experience of not having a voice and, you know, having these struggles and realizing that it's all the same. And those things work hand in hand. So after going public, we pushed forward and had a series of escalating actions, drawing attention to this and demanding recognition, demanding that they be recognized as a union, culminating after about 4 months of basically convincing OHSU that there's no possible way that they are going to win this, that no matter how much they fought it, we were going to form a union either way. And that experience of making what was previously impossible and what the institution said was impossible as possible by coming together, like the core of this is that workers themselves came together and built this union themselves, then they saw that, oh, wait, we actually can change things. And I think that's what's powerful, is by coming together and pushing against these institutional things that are not presented as, you know, the thing saying, oh, you're students, like, we still care about you, is presented not as, you know, oppressive, but it actually is.
Another institution telling workers that they don't belong in a union is Multnomah County and temp and on-call workers. They signed a majority of cards to join the union 2 years ago, and the county told them that they don't, quote-unquote, share a community of interests, which is another way of saying that they don't do the same work. And after, you know, numerous actions and showing up to testify at a board meeting, county board meeting, the county has backed off of that particular claim and is instead trying to allow the union but control who gets to be in it still by saying that a majority of on-call workers still don't get to belong, and there's a fight on that end. But that's one of the other themes of this book, is the casualization of work and how that is part of the new logics of production that characterize capitalist realism. But unfortunately, we don't have enough time to talk more about that. Is there any last thoughts you have, Kevin, on this?
No, I think that's a really good example. I think that the key is that, you know, you have to talk about these things, and that building this collective consciousness and having unions that aren't just transactional, that are actually centered, grounded in workers building their own consciousness, is essential to actually pushing through this sort of capitalist realism.
For the Old Mole Variety Hour, I'm Joe Clement, and this has been Kevin Dugan.
Thanks, Joe.
Well, I'm tired of working my life away.
And that's Working Girl Blues by Hazel Dickens and Alice Gerard. And that concludes today's Old Mole. Many thanks to Fran Michel for her great discussion of the International Women's Strike coming up on March 8th and about the Notes for a Feminist Manifesto. Let me remind you that the strike, rally, and march will start on Friday at 4 at Portland's Pioneer Courthouse Square. Thanks also to Cynthia Aruzza and Bill Resnick for their discussion of the Women's Strike USA and the manifesto she helped to write. Thanks to Jan Hocken for telling us about her new film, which will be shown this Friday evening at 8:45 and the following Tuesday at 6 on March 12th. Those showings will be at Witzel Auditorium at the Portland Art Museum. You'll be able to find details on our webpage for today's show at kboo.fm/oldmole. Today's show should be up in a day or two. And finally, thanks to Joe Clement and Kevin Dugan for their discussion of capitalist realism. I've been your host today, Clayton Morgeridge. Our peerless engineer is Patricia Kullberg. Tune in again next Monday at 9 o'clock for more news, views, reviews, and interviews from the Mole's underground perspective.